Good afternoon. Welcome to the, what day is it? March 25th meeting of the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development. And members, we have a very full agenda today, so we want to get right started. And we will start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 200. And we have a lot of people who've worked very hard on this bill, a number of whom have shown up today to tell us about it. I also, before we start, want to mention to you that there is written testimony from Trevor Steele, and he has asked that that be entered into the record, so we will do that. And we will start by calling forward Rick Crager and Clyde Psyche, if you both could please come forward. And Jeremy, do you want to just briefly introduce this bill?
Sure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 200, I have a short description of what it does. It defines and describes the effect of homelessness and it establishes state policies to guide efforts to address the problems of homelessness. And that's a short description, but it covers a large topic.
Great. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Rick Crager. I'm the Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services. In addition, I am the chair of the Governor's Ending Homelessness Advisory Council. I appreciate the opportunity today to come and talk to you about Senate Bill 200, and I think staff said it well. Essentially, this bill is requesting to create a statewide policy to provide guidance and direction in Oregon's fight to end homelessness. Prior to giving you a little overview of the bill, I'd like to give you first a little background as well as kind of where we're at as it relates to homelessness in Oregon. First of all, overall, in 2008, the department's one-night shelter count counted 12,529 people that were homeless on any given night. That represented about a 9% growth from 2008. I think one of the more startling things is of those counted, 51% of them were families. Typically, people think of homeless individuals as the individual on the street, and certainly there are a lot of that across the state, but 51% represented those that were in families. Even more startling than that, though, was that approximately 21%, or 2,700, were children 11 and under. Now, to add some additional data to that, because, again, this is one source of data, it's at any given point on one night in the state of Oregon, but through the Department of Education, they provide additional information as it relates to homeless children, and what they found in their most recent study is that 15,517 students were homeless during all or part of the school year in their last information. So again, the homeless population we're talking about here is more than just the single individual, it is the family. Focus a little bit on the special needs of each of these individuals. In 2008, 5,641 individuals were seeking some form of service. Now, what were they seeking? 88% of them reported a mental or emotional disorder, some form of substance abuse, or both. Nearly 25% were affected by domestic violence, and 23% had some form of physical disability. So what we're talking about here in our homeless population is very complex issues, people that are suffering from a variety of things. One of the very important trends that we have seen in our one-night shelter count since 2002, compared 2002 to 2008, we've seen a 75% increase in the number of people that are seeking services on any given night through the one-night shelter count. So we have seen dramatic increases in our homeless population. So what has been our response? In 2006, the governor created, through executive order, the Oregon's, Ending Homelessness Advisory Council, EHAC as we know it. This is a council that I serve on, Mr. Psyche serves on as well. It's 24 members made up of members of the legislature, directors or delegates from 9 other agencies, and 13 additional members representing cities, counties, and a variety of housing and anti-poverty organizations. As a council, one of our principal tasks was to create a state's 10-year plan to end homelessness. Now, I'm telling you right now, Madam Chair, member of the committees, the first initial meetings that we had, my experience was very interesting. We all kind of talked in our own variety of silos. One of the comments that first came up is, well, we should be able to wrap this plan up in 3 months. No problem. Well, I think after After 3 months of talking, debating, arguing, agreeing and disagreeing, I think we found that it was going to be a lot harder than we initially anticipated. One of the breakthroughs, I believe, for us came in the summer of 2007, it was. And that was our opportunity to go to Central City Concern in Portland, Oregon, and actually meet the homeless population. As a committee, we actually met and asked the question. And for me, one of the startling things was, again, how complex the issue was and how real it was, and certainly the people that we were dealing with. And I think we learned a great deal about that issue, and we recognized that it was going to be a matter of us stepping outside the box and really putting together strategies that were going to work together in collaboration to try to solve this problem. As a result, in July of last year, and I think you all have copies, we released this, A Home for Hope, and this was the state's 10-year plan to end homelessness. Senate Bill 200 represents a key part of this. It represents a first step in implementing the state's plan through creating a guiding policy necessary to end homelessness. So let me talk a little bit about Senate Bill 200 now that I've given you some background. First of all, let me tell you what Senate Bill 200 is not. It is not a funding mandate. It is not requiring anyone to do a certain program. It's simply a policy statement that acknowledges that homelessness is a serious problem in this state, and it calls for a comprehensive and collaborative approach to ending the problem. Within the bill, there are four key pieces that are critical to the success. First, a focus on permanent housing with appropriate support service rather than temporary solution. As a state, we have to begin talking about permanent solutions to homelessness. We can't continue to just quick fix the problem. We need to start moving to permanent solutions. We see from a nationwide standpoint, it works. It's working in a variety of different states, and in this state, we want to continue those efforts. Number two, it requires enhanced collaboration between local, county, state, and federal agencies that deliver integrated and cost-effective programs. Behind me, there are a variety of local folks. There's a federal governments here. There's county officials. We all have to work together to be able to make to end the problem of homelessness. Number three, the policy calls for measurable outcomes focused on housing stability. We need to start moving people from the temporary, from the shelter system, into permanent housing and stability. And finally, number four, it's a recognition of the need for an individualized approach. There's not one program that fixes the problem of homelessness. Again, if you ask the population, if you look at the data, you have a variety of problems that create homelessness situation. It requires an individualized approach to solving the problem, and you're not going to develop just one program that fixes everything. Madam Chair, that's the majority of my comments, but in closing, I just wanted to point you to, you may have read in the news a couple weeks ago, the National Center on Family Homelessness released a report. It was a report card on America's youngest outcast. And one of the things when you turn to Oregon, and I quote, in 2008, the Ending Homelessness Advisory Council created a Home for Hope, a 10-year plan to end homelessness in Oregon. This plan contains an extensive focus on children and families experiencing homelessness, as well as goals to increase access to affordable housing, increase access to supportive service, and create public education programs to remove the stigma of homelessness and improve data collection techniques. They gave us a grade on that, and of it, it was they had three categories: early stages, inadequate, moderate, and extensive. We receive extensive. We're one of only six states in the nation that receive extensive planning. But I also point to this report, and it talks about the state's rank, 1 through 50, 1 being best, 50 being the worst, 37th in the number of homeless children. Overall, I think we received a rating of 26, so we were medium. So, Madam Chair, I guess what I'm trying to say, it's time for Oregon to move from excellence in planning and start moving to excellence in meeting the needs of needy adults, children and families experiencing homelessness. Senate Bill 200 helps us to begin establishing the parameters in which we meet those needs. Senate Bill 200 is a good bill. It's a good policy. I request your support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Clyde Psyche. I'm the Deputy Director of Operations for the Department of Human Services. And homelessness and hunger are two of the major issues being faced by our clients in today's difficult environment. People with mental illness, children aging out of the child welfare system, people who find themselves without a job are severely impacted by the lack of affordable housing and the lack of programs that deal with homelessness issues. We also know that people experiencing chronic homelessness use a disproportionate share of state services and impact other parts of our service delivery system. During the past 2 years, we've had the opportunity to work with Housing and Community Service on the Ending Homelessness Advisory Council and the Interagency Council on Hunger and Homelessness. These committees have brought us together and provided us an opportunity to look at issues of homelessness and hunger in a holistic way. The committees provide us an opportunity to collaborate and break down the silos that exist in our various service delivery systems. And in this time of scarce resources, it's even more critical that we are working together in maximizing the resources we have to deal with these two important issues. This bill is more than just a statement on homelessness. It formalizes and ratifies something that works and sets out a mandate that we need to work differently to end the problems of homelessness and hunger in the state of Oregon. It also creates a framework that will allow us to further the work that is already being done and presents opportunities to collaborate and maximize resources. We urge the committee to pass this bill and give us another tool in our fight against hunger and homelessness in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And members, I would love to have time for questions, but we have so many people signed up as well as other bills to hear that I think we're going to, unless anybody has anything urgent, we're going to keep moving. Okay,
just a real quick question. If someone wanted to get a homeless shelter, say, in the Gresham area, is there funding? Where would they go? Who would they even go to say, we have a problem? Where would we go?
Madam Chair, Senator Mona Anderson, in terms of a shelter assistant, there are a variety of different supports. The local community action agency, Gresham is in what county? That's
Multnomah.
That would be Multnomah County actually administers the community action agency. So they could get information for shelter from that particular program. And certainly, Senator, I'd be happy to provide you some additional.
You do that?
I would be happy to give you, and along with some additional information my staff could provide you in terms of connecting.
Thank you. Although the city of Gresham says we don't have a homeless problem.
Okay. Thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next panel we'll call Bill Hall and Donna Bolt and John Atten. If the three of you would all like to come forward. Thank you for being here today. And whichever of you wants to go first, I think our list has Bill going first. So
okay.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. My name is Bill Hall. I'm a county commissioner in Lincoln County, and I am serving as vice chair of the Oregon Ending Homelessness Advisory Council. I co-wrote the Lincoln County 10-year plan to end homelessness, and I also chair the committee implementing that plan. At the local level, I serve on the board of our family homeless shelter, our domestic violence shelter, and was formerly involved with a nonprofit providing alcohol and drug-free housing. So, as you may have gathered, I'm very passionate about the issue of housing. Today, I want to talk a little bit about our local success story and how I see an interaction between our local work and my work on the state committee. I think the state plan provides a comprehensive look at the face of homelessness in Oregon and does lay out a detailed action plan for ending it. Senate Bill 200 is an important step toward achieving that goal. And I think it is important to emphasize this bill does not create any new expense for state government. It redefines the role of both state and local agencies to work together and better and develop comprehensive responses that also encompass the private sector, including the faith community. I am particularly pleased that the measure emphasizes the importance of innovation and collaboration at both the state and local levels. The completion of our Lincoln County plan has allowed us to launch some new initiatives and leverage some new resources, including a runaway and homeless youth initiative, an expanded rent assistance program, creation of a community land trust. We're hoping to launch a community resource center too, and at the heart of the plan, creation of permanent supportive housing. Our first 6 units opened last October, and we've just secured funding for another 12 units in a county of 45,000. I think that's going to have a huge impact. Our team approach, though, has also enabled us to make sure that we're using what we already have to the maximum benefit. Our early plan development meetings, I found to be amazing to find that so many of those represented business community, faith community, local representatives of state government, our local governments, our private nonprofits had never all been at the same table to discuss this issue before. I saw a similar phenomenon when I joined the State Homeless Council. One agency didn't know what another offered in the way of homeless services. I think this bill can really help us to start breaking down those silos. And the bill makes clear, I think, that homelessness has far-reaching consequences, social and economic. And those impacts can extend to future generations. You know, we've seen a dramatic increase in homelessness in our state in recent years, even in good economic times. And now, with our nation in the midst of its worst economic crisis in 70 years, we're already starting to see a new wave of homelessness. This bill sets a different framework for all of us involved to draft integrated and more effective responses. You know, I'm saddened to see anyone of any age dealing with homelessness, but I think it's particularly tragic among children. As you heard, more than half of the Oregon homeless population consists of families with children. It is well documented that homeless children have more health problems, more behavior problems, and are less likely to succeed in school. Robert Kennedy liked to quote Albert Camus to the effect that perhaps this world is a world in which children suffer. But we can lessen the number of suffering children. And if you do not do this, then who will do this? I think Senate Bill 200 is one building block toward creation of a system that can reduce the number of suffering children. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for all your great work. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum and members of the committee. I'm Donna Bolt, for the record. I am the coordinator for the Homeless Education Program at the Oregon Department of Education. This is a program that's been federally funded by the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act for 22 years, and I'm proud to say that I've been there all 22 years. And every year we have done analyses and counts of the nature and extent of homeless children and families in our public schools. When I originally began this job and we did the first count, we had 6,000 children approximately that we had counted, and that was through the shelters and other systems. We are now looking at almost 20,000 students. These are students that are enrolled in our public schools who are facing homelessness and the deprivations and mobility that are caused by homelessness. And now we are starting to study preschool children, which we know will be an even larger cohort than most of the grade span level homeless kids. We used to say, and I still believe this is very true, that for children who are between birth and 5, homelessness is so devastating on their development that they create a time bomb for our public schools. When that child enters school and has not been around printed media, has not been around instruction of any kind, and has received that the trauma and the stress, their development is affected, and that makes it even harder for the school system to educate the children and harder for them to keep up with their peers. And so it's really important for us to recognize the school districts for all of the work they have been doing. And I can tell you for sure Gresham Barlow School District has a homeless count because those kids have been counted and counted and recounted, and the numbers are continuing to rise every year. And as Commissioner Hall just said, with this new economic recession that we're under, we're expecting to see a lot of new families, and our count next year is going to be a lot higher. The one thing I do want to say about this, the EHEC group and the formation of the Interagency Council, is that this is the kind of model that we would like to see at the local county level. This interagency approach where everybody is at the table bringing their data and their collective resources together to think this out and not zeroing in on a particular part of the population without looking at the big picture first. So if we can model that for counties, then we're doing our job. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for your work and all your years of great work. And please go ahead. Welcome to our committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum and committee members. My name is John Atten. I'm a recovering heroin addict and a survivor of homelessness. And I never really thought I'd be saying that to a body of legislators. I'm going to editorialize for just a hot second. What I've heard here today from Mr. Hall and Mr. Krager, in particular, is the silo effect and the fact that none of these providers had ever really been at the table. All I can say is try navigating that as a consumer at some point, and it brings on a whole new perspective. I support Senate Bill 200 because this bill will bring to Oregon the potential to deliver statewide a model of coordinated housing and services similar to that which has served me and thousands of others so very effectively. There are many in the recovering community who offer the wisdom that recovery is a process, not an event. So it is with addiction, and so it is with homelessness. In the course of a 15-year addiction to heroin, I have had many attempts at treatment for the judge, for my girlfriend, for my family, for everybody but myself. In all of these cases, I was eventually sent back to where I started, to the same old friends, same community, and same bad habits. There came a point at which I no longer had the resources to sustain a normal existence. I was homeless. I had lost my friends, I had lost my family, my job, and any sense of the integrity with which I was raised. I wanted desperately to stop, but I didn't know how. Where I came from, to get on methadone required a wait of 6 to 8 weeks. To enter detox, I had to somehow show that I would have a treatment bed when I got out. To get a treatment bed required insurance and another wait list. To get even the basic state health plan was another 6 to 8 week wait, several appointments, and reams of paperwork. And they wanted to mail me stuff. I was homeless. I was very sick, addicted, and homeless, and I was unable to manage this level of complexity in order to get help. In desperation, I called Hooper Detox in Portland. I described my situation, and they asked if I could be there at 7:30 in the morning. After 12 days of acute withdrawal, I was enrolled immediately in treatment and in the Central City Concerned Recovery Mentor Program. I was given the key to a room in the old Danmore building where I stayed during 90-plus days of treatment. The Danmore provided a clean and sober community of people who shared a common purpose, to live again and recover. The mentor program offered a guide who had been there before, had been down that same road I was on, and who would hold me accountable as I negotiated the trials of early recovery. From there, I was enrolled in CCC's WorkSource program, where I was given the tools to leverage my existing work skills into the start of a new career. Today, I'm the manager of occupancy and compliance for all of Central City Concerns Housing, totaling over 1,300 affordable units, with like 300 more in the works. In this capacity, I work extensively with Oregon Housing and Community Services to ensure the effective delivery of CCC's housing model to some of the most challenging and hardest to house populations in Portland. I present my story today in order that you might see what can be accomplished by pairing housing with a coordinated continuum of services. For most like me, there usually develops a window in which the horror and misery of where we find ourselves overshadows the fear of the unknown, the fear of asking for help, and the fear of facing the wreckage we have created in our own lives and the lives of others. But ultimately, at a moment when I became willing, the availability of treatment, employment services, and safe supportive housing were key to becoming who I am today. I'm here today as a concerned citizen, a registered voter, and a member of the recovering community. But most important to me, I represent the person who can't be here because the underlying cause of their homelessness has not yet been addressed. My name is John Atten, and I put the needle in my vein for the last time on October 31st, 2003. I've been clean for 1,969 days due to the efforts of people such as yourselves and others who believe that my addiction and my homelessness were not permanent conditions. I appreciate your time today and all the good work you do, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have for me.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and especially for talking about personal experience. Any brief questions for this panel? Senator Munis Anderson.
When you were on the streets, maybe you weren't even aware of what the other people who were homeless were like, but some are motivated. You obviously were motivated, but there are some that aren't motivated.
Whoa, there's a hot potato, isn't it? I think I can't even say everybody. What I've learned working where I work is, you know, there are different causes for homelessness. In my story, there was a pretty clear and present motivation. It took 15 years to figure out, but, it became obvious I needed to do something. There are those, you know, when I hear about a 10-year plan to end homelessness, it's a noble pursuit, but there will always be that portion of the population who is there by choice. And then there is the other, you know, there are other people that I work with in particular who, you know, mental illness was not part of my journey, but I see it, and motivation may not be part of that story. So, editorial comment, I guess.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to ask you, John, about the importance of services being available when somebody is ready to accept them, because you talked a lot about these waiting lists and all the bureaucracy.
Another hot potato. there is generally, I don't know if it came clear in my testimony, but there's a lot, there are often times where somebody is mandated to treatment or mandated to services. And for me, in my world, what I learned was the minute I'm doing it because I have to, it changes the equation. I had to get to a point where I was making that investment because I needed to make the investment in myself and own it. And that window often isn't very big. And so the ability to, you know, when I called Hooper and they said, can you be here at 7:30 a.m., I was able to jump right on it instead of, can you be here in 2 months? That was beyond the scope of my vision. So, yeah, huge part.
Thank you. And thank you all for being here.
Thanks.
Today. Next, we'll call Tammy Bainey and Lee Means and Chris Flaming. Hope I'm not butchering your names too badly. And if you could all come forward together, that would be great. Tammy, I know that you traveled from some distance to get here, so.
I did. Thank you. And I brought my part of me with me.
Even better.
May I?
So please go ahead, whoever wants to go first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and my favorite Senator Telfer from my area, great to see you. My name is Tammy Bainey, and I am a Deschutes County Commissioner. I've been elected for 2 years and a couple of months, and I brought with me my daughter, Addie Bainey, who is 9. And I also am before you today as a foster mom of 3 grown daughters who are just one paycheck away from what we're talking about today. 2 of them have children, and quite frankly, I'm not sure what would happen in one paycheck to 2 of my foster daughters. So in coming to you today, I wanted to paint a picture. Often people think of Deschutes County as a wonderful place to visit and then go back to where it might rain. We are able to ski and golf in the same day. It is beautiful. We have 350-some days of sunshine every year. However, we also have been experiencing homelessness and unemployment at levels that are just uncanny. And I wanted to paint a picture with some statistics, and I'll try not to bore you to tears. But Deschutes County's population from 2000 to 2007 grew at 33%. The state of Oregon was at 9.5. We really were enjoying those times. However, now things have changed. Our population for Deschutes County is 160,000 people, and we have the second highest overvalued home prices in the United States of America. America, next to Atlanta, Georgia. And so when we start talking about affordable housing in our community, we have dropped off 43% to the value of our homes. Our unemployment jumped the sixth largest number in the state or in the United States of unemployment from January to January in the U.S., from 6.1% to 12.6%. That was the sixth highest jump in 1 year in the United States. We are seeing suicide rates in our community that are uncanny as well. We have builders who are unable to handle the market and are choosing that as their way out. So as I paint that picture, I would like you to know that we, on January 9th, held our one-night homeless count. And we had 1,873 people on that one day, January 9th of this year, that were homeless. And of those, 767 were children. And so I didn't know exactly how to ship them all here today. So I went ahead and just made some very, I'm not an artist, but I can work a computer. So I just wanted to show you exactly how many school buses, if each one of those held 65 kids. I wanted to just show you how many school buses I would have had to have brought today to bring you the kids from Deschutes County that do not have a place to stay. In Deschutes County, we also have rural and urban areas, and the difficulty with that is we have the newest city in the state of 1,500 people, and we have the city of Bend, which is 85,000. So meeting those needs of access and being able to reach those that are in need creates interesting issues. For us, we have in Deschutes County 12 places for families for emergency shelter. 12. We have 767 children that are homeless, and they are not able to fit into those 12 units that we have available. The difficulty that's posed is, and Senator, you had brought up the question of how do we fund a shelter. Often those that need emergency shelter are not able to serve them with the funds that are available through the federal government. The strings are too many. And it creates a burden. We have the region's homeless shelter, the Bethlehem Inn, serving Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson County, and it can house 60 people. And they have 3 units, and we also have 3 other family units as well. People are left to our motels, which, as you know, motels that you can afford on a nightly basis are not exactly where you'd like to raise your children. So talking about those needs, I impress upon you the need that we need to remember that some communities do not have the systems in place to be able to move from temporary to permanent housing, which is a huge component within Senate Bill 200 and the 10-year plan to end homelessness. I don't believe that we will end homelessness because there will always be a component of chronic homelessness, because there's a difference between chronic or generational homelessness and situational homelessness. For us, about 2% are chronic, and the rest are not there situational. In my neighborhood alone, and there are 42 homes in my neighborhood, 6 went into foreclosure. 1 in every 167 properties in Deschutes County are in foreclosure. So we're talking about a level of people, as the gentleman who had the courage to share his story, John, they do not know how to navigate this system. They do not know where to turn for help. And if we can get past the pride issues of just needing to discuss with someone what they might be experiencing, we may be able to make some inroads, but the system is too difficult to navigate. So I encourage you to support Senate Bill 200 for the main reason that it helps us work better together. And I can tell you that on the local level, we've had great programs and people doing a lot of work, but as elected officials and from the top down, I don't know that we've really felt the essence of what it means to end homelessness in our communities. The 10-year plan to end homelessness does just that. It takes it from the top and puts the partnership back into the grassroots and combines all the efforts to instill into communities what's necessary for that continuum of services. So it does not have a fiscal impact per se, but it will have a fiscal impact in saving money down the road, because we will be able to meet the need better by having this in place. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Lee Means. I'm the Executive Director of Yamhill Community
Ms.
Action.
Means, if you can get one of the microphones closer to you.
Thank you.
Just one.
Yeah,
because we'll get feedback.
That's right. I have dual voice there. My name is Lee Means. I'm the Executive Director of Yamhill Community Action Partnership. That's a nonprofit that serves low-income seniors and disabled and runaway homeless youth in Yamhill County. But I'm not here specifically as the executive director of a CAP agency. I'm here as representing the committee that we put together a year and a half ago to draft the first 10-year plan to end homelessness in Yamhill County. Commissioner County Commissioner Kathy George led this committee. It was made up of all of, I don't even know how many nonprofits and other people in the county serving the homeless to pull this draft plan together. She couldn't be here today, so she asked me to come in her place. I have over the years in many, many different places, also and as time allowed, served as a volunteer, a literacy volunteer. And one of the places that I was most impacted as a literacy volunteer, I was working in a county jail trying to help inmates get their GEDs so that they could at least possibly get a job when they got out, so they wouldn't go back into the same old, not having a job, not being able to, being homeless, falling back with the bad crowd they were in that got them into jail in the first place. One day I was working with a young man named Michael, and I said, out of frustration, "For heaven's sakes, Michael, where were you in the third grade that you did not learn your multiplication tables? You cannot do math without learning your multiplication, and you just have to memorize it. What were you doing in the third grade?" And he just looked at me and said, "I was in seven different schools in the third grade. We were homeless." That impacted me immensely, and I realized we have been fighting the war on poverty for 40-plus years since Johnson's era and started the war on poverty. We have been pouring billions of dollars into education, into police and courts and jails and corrections. We pour a ton of money into health care and emergency room visits and paramedics for homeless people. We have drug and alcohol services. They have not won the war on poverty. We have not even touched it. It's getting worse. And the reason we're not winning the war on poverty or the war on homelessness is that there is no leadership. We have all these different people out doing fabulous jobs, but there's no integration. There's no collaboration. There's not the kind of combined forces that will lead a war to success. There's no broad perspective, no overarching, not one leader that's coordinating all the forces. And there's no understanding that people have to be stabilized before you can help them make changes in their lives. They have to have stable, safe places to be. To win the war on poverty and the war on homelessness, people have to be housed first. Children can't learn if they're moving around, if they're living out of a car. Families can't be healthy. They can't cook the food boxes they get. They can't learn good nutrition if they don't have a place to cook. People can't consistently get to counseling, to medical, to referral services, if they're always on the move and they don't know where they're going to be the next day. And most important, we need to have someone who coordinates all those efforts together. We just completed this 10-year plan. It's still a draft plan because one of the things we did was conduct our first full homeless count. That count was the first time we just went out in the communities and really counted. Because it was in the January, because the weather was so horrible, we found many of the camps empty. We counted over 610 people, but we also knew, because most of the camps were empty, that many people were couch surfing and we couldn't find them. We have in Yamhill County about 350 beds for people who need shelter. Of that, we My agency operates 3 transitional homes for families, and the rest are drug and alcohol beds for people who are in recovery. That doesn't come anywhere close to meeting the needs of the homeless people in Yamhill County. We desperately need good, safe housing and shelters for all of these people that are on the street. We're never going to get people off the street if we don't have places to put them. And one of the most critical things is to have housing for people who are currently using and need wraparound services. So the first step to winning the war on poverty and homelessness is stable housing. Senate Bill 200 is that first step. It coordinates and integrates the forces under one command, and it makes takes the broad perspective and is able to bring people together. Michael ended up in jail and had difficulty getting jobs throughout his life because he was homeless in the third grade. And it's time now for us to do something different in this war. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you for all your great work, and thank you for your testimony. And please go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum and members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Chris Flamang, and I'm a resident of Coos County. I'm also a member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 200 that would establish a policy toward Oregon's response to homelessness. And I want to thank you now for this opportunity to speak to you about this bill. The issue of affordable housing for older Oregonians has been a major focus of the Governor's Commission for most of this decade. Homelessness factors in as a significant worst case level of housing concerns. Since the 5th White House Conference on Aging in 2005, in which I was a delegate from Oregon, followed by a statewide effort by the Governor's Commission to provide public input in 2006 across the state, the need for affordable, adequate, and accessible housing has consistently been among the major areas identified by the public relating to senior issues. More recently, in 2008, the Commission revisited the communities of Astoria, Lake Oswego, Medford, and Ontario over a period of 4 months, holding community forums for public dialogue. Housing was again among the significant priorities voiced by community members. Senate Bill 200 sets forth the official policy of the state of Oregon regarding homelessness through a focus upon permanent housing rather than temporary solutions. Additionally, in doing so, the state will have stepped forward to assert that whenever possible, housing first becomes the viable response to homeless situations. This bill reflects the many 10-year plans that are being developed or have been developed throughout counties here in Oregon, and I have worked on the development of Coos County's 10-year plan. As homelessness impacts all age groups, including seniors, and since it has been exacerbated by current economic conditions, the Governor's Commission strongly urges the passage of Senate Bill 200, clearly establishing Oregon's philosophy and setting benchmarks towards solutions for homelessness. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And are there any brief questions for this panel? Okay. And Senator George, I think you were out of the room, but your mother's work was mentioned very strongly in some of the testimony we heard. So, Okay. Well, thank you again. And that completes our list of witnesses who have signed up to testify. So, members, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 200. And it appears that we have received statements of no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on this bill. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 200. And Senator Telfer.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 200 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Telfer has moved Senate Bill 200 to the floor with the do pass recommendation. Are there any comments or any discussion? Yes, Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you. I really think that we need to address this. We have in City of Gresham, it's called Springwater Trail, and if you go down that, you have to get, they hide themselves very well, but there are camps out there, and some have said they like it out there. There's a camaraderie among them. They're even, and I say, how do you make your living? And they say, well, we do shoplift, we steal. Some had were even ingenious enough to hook up electrical system to some business and had this long wire. I mean, they're very creative in dealing with their homelessness. And finally, this one family had a 16-year-old daughter with them, and she had dropped out of high school, she had become pregnant. And so finally, there was some form of assistance that she was getting as a pregnant gal, so they were able to get some stable housing with the just enough for them to have funding. So, I mean, what a sad way, but now I've contacted them, and they still have their stable housing, and she's delivering any time this month. But a sad situation, and I really feel we need to get a handle on this.
Other comments from committee members? We do need to move on because we have other bills to hear. I just would say, although this bill has no fiscal impact, that clearly it's great to have a plan, and leadership certainly is part of the solution, but resources also have to be part of the solution, and that's a difficult challenge right now, but nonetheless, it's one that we're going to have to meet eventually. So, with no further comments, Pam, would you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. And I think the fact that this is such a significant bill would warrant having co-carriers. So, Vice Chair Telfer, would you be willing
to
co-carry it with me? Great. So that's what we'll do, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 200. And, members, we have several bills, and a lot of the same people have signed up to testify on them. So I think I'm going to open screens on all of these bills at once, so as people come forward, they can talk about more than one bill. So I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2256, 2257, 2258, and 2259. And Rick Crager, if you'd like to come forward. And please re-identify yourself, although we certainly know who you are.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Rick Crager, Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services. And I'll start by saying that I wish all these bills that I'm about ready to present were as exciting as Senate Bill 200. There's a lot, I hope you can see there was a lot of passion behind the testimony here today. It's a very important bill. I guess I want to officially thank you for your passage. The bills that I'm about to present are much more technical in nature and perhaps a little drier, so I apologize in advance. But I will start with House Bill 2256. House Bill 2256 requests to allow the State Housing Council to adopt guidelines for loan and grant threshold approval for all applicable housing programs. Quick background, the Oregon Housing Community Services is governed by a council composed of seven-member boards board charged with approving the majority of housing grants and loans. In 2005, we had a legislative concept that changed our residential loan program. This is our single-family program. We had a dollar amount for what the threshold for in which the State Housing Council had to approve those loans. The State Housing Council believed at that time that because the market is always changing, that it would be best to put into law the ability for the council to set those thresholds based on wherever the market may be at any given point. The legislature unanimously approved that bill, and the department worked with the State Housing Council to develop a guideline in which those single-family program thresholds were approved. It's worked very successfully. What we're asking through House Bill 2256 is to now allow the department to change the remaining programs which govern our multifamily programs. Currently, there's a threshold in place of a $100,000 loan or grant. Again, the State Housing Council would like to receive legislative approval to change that to enable them to set those thresholds based on what they deem appropriate. This particular bill has no fiscal impact and, again, would just simply change the rule to enable State Housing Council to set thresholds. So, Madam Chair, that concludes my testimony, and happy to answer any questions on House Bill 2256.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Any questions about this bill, Senator Montes?
I'm not quite sure. It says a threshold of is this property for what purpose?
Madam Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, what these would be for loans and or grants in which we give to, could be for not-for-profit organizations, for-profit organizations, okay, to actually develop multifamily,
gotcha,
housing.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay. Thank you for that testimony. And if you'd like to move on to the other bills, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2257 requests to the legislature that requests to have OHCS and the State Housing Council review and approval authority for the community incentive funds related to loans and grants used for preserving affordable housing. And let me provide you a little bit background on this. In 1999, the Community Incentive Fund, which we call CIF, was created to provide grants and loans for three purposes. Those purposes were, one, revitalizing centers of community activity, promoting affordable housing near jobs and transportation, and rebuilding rural and distressed economies. In addition, in 1999, there was a CIF advisory board, which was created to review applications and make recommendations for the approval of these. Again, they were advisory board to the director of Oregon Housing Community Services to approve these projects. Between 1999 and 2005, the Community Incentive Fund provided $17.7 million in funding for 108 projects across the state. In 2005, the legislature redirected the use of the remaining community incentive funds, to be used specifically for the preservation of affordable housing. And many of you may recall during the last session there was a lot of attention given to preserving projects that had federally subsidized housing assistance that were expiring. There were a lot of efforts put forth to try to preserve those projects, so because there was a shortage of resources, it was decided that the Community Incentive Fund dollars could be a source for this. So what we found in 2007-09 is we now had essentially redundant processes. We took all of our housing loans to the State Housing Council, but by law, if it had Community Incentive Fund, we had to also go to the Community Incentive Fund Advisory Board so they could recommend it to the director for approval. So we had redundant processes. What this bill asks for is to change any time that there is a grant and or loan that's specific to preserving affordable housing in Oregon, that it only have to go through one process, and that be the State Housing Council. Now, currently, the legislature has directed that the Community Incentive Fund only be used for the preservation of affordable housing. There hasn't been any other Community Incentive Fund type projects since 2005. So at some point, the legislature may decide that they want to start that program again, and the advisory board would be in place to do that. But at this point, since the money is only directed that, we're asking for a change in law that would enable just the State Housing Council and the department to approve those type of loans. Again, Madam Chair, no fiscal impact related to this bill. Would only change the process and make it much more efficient.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. Any questions about this bill?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So give me an idea of the other duties of the Community Development Incentive Advisory Board at this point, and are they currently active?
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator George, currently there is a body that's formed because we still have to have that board in place because the law says that we have to go through them. So the only purpose that they're serving at this point is reviewing current grants or loans that we make for preservation of affordable housing. They have said they've also said, why are we looking at these loans when they're already being reviewed by the State Housing Council? So that's the only purpose that they're playing at this point.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Mm-hmm.
So if this passes, is there a purpose to have at this point, have the Community Development Incentive Advisory Board at all?
Madam Chair, Senator George, the only reason to keep it in place would be is that if the legislature came back and decided that they wanted to restart the Community Incentive Fund for the original purposes that were established in 1999.
One final question.
Go ahead.
What's the amount of money that is spent keeping the Community Development Incentive Advisory Board going, and could those dollars be spent someplace else, or is it a significant amount of money?
Madam Chair, Senator George, insignificant. We don't pay them any type of per diem or anything, so.
Great, thanks.
We pretty much do it all by phone call right now.
Okay, great, thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments on that bill, and I think the next bill on our list is 2258, and I've been remiss having made a mistake once, I decided to compound it by making it twice and didn't ask the committee administrator to talk about the previous bill. So if you'd like to talk about the next bill three times, please go ahead.
I think once will suffice, and my description probably won't be that different, I hope, from Mr. Krager's. Madam Chair, 2258A changes the definition of lower-income household for purpose of statutes relating to individual development accounts, IDAs, administered by Housing and Community Services Department. It authorizes the Housing and Community Services Department to determine poverty guidelines. It allows the department the option of using additional sources of data beyond that published by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development when determining eligibility of low-income households. It has revenue impact, as statement is issued, and has no fiscal impact.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With your permission, I would like to invite Cynthia from Neighborhood Partnership Fund to join me. She's the contractor that helps administer the program, and she's going to provide a little bit of testimony.
That would be great.
Thank you. Again, Madam Chair, the request through House Bill 2258 is to change the eligible income levels for the individual development account program to the greater of 80% area median income or 200% of federal poverty level. Just again, some background. What is the IDA program? Some of you may ask. This is a tax credit program administered through Oregon Housing Community Services, of which we have a contractor in place that helps us with this. Tax credits are sold to generate proceeds to provide low-income Oregonians for a match to savings that will be used for a variety of purposes. One of those could be education, another down payment assistance for home ownership, or it could be for small business development. And again, Cynthia can talk a little bit more about the program. Currently, the program serves individuals at 80% of area median income. One of the things that we learned during this biennium was that there, in many cases, particularly in the rural parts of the state, that we were finding there were certain levels of income that were being left off. And that was specifically to people that were earning less than 200% of the federal poverty level. We found this very relevant, again, particularly in the rural parts of the state, that in larger families, people that were at 200% federal poverty level and below, but were higher than the 80% area median income, were not being served, couldn't access this program. So we believe that we wanted to change the rules so that it would enable us to serve
people that were the greater of 80% area mean income or 200% federal poverty level. There was a small amendment that was made in on the House side when this was heard, and that was essentially just allowing us to use a variety of other type of research information to be able to determine the different levels of federal poverty. So, again, in summary, this would enable us to serve more families and be able to serve that gap of individuals that would be left out. No fiscal impact related to this bill, and with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. I'll turn it over to Cynthia.
Great.
I should add, members of the committee, that there's a minimal revenue impact, and we'll have copies of that for you in just a minute.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Montes Anderson.
I always get, this is the first year that I didn't get a statement that shows what is the actual income levels corresponding to the poverty level. Is there a possibility to get that?
We can actually, I could send that to
just
you.
Just email it.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Or, yeah.
Okay.
Actually, if you would email that to our committee administrator as well, I think other members might be interested.
Okay.
So please go ahead. We're interested in your
testimony. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Cynthia Winter. I'm a program director at the Neighborhood Partnership Fund, and we oversee the Oregon IDA initiative, or the Individual Development Account initiative. As Rick was talking, mentioning, what we're asking of you today is a pretty straightforward, simple modification to the bill. But I thought it would be a good opportunity to sort of share with you some of the impact this program is having on helping to build Oregon's middle class. The IDA initiative is an innovative match savings program that's designed to help hardworking Oregonians gain assets. It's funded through the IDA tax credit, and the statute's very clear on what types of assets people can save for. There's actually five that are approved. It's buying a first-time home. It's going back and getting an education, starting a small business. It can also be used for assistive technology to assist individuals to get back into the workforce, as well as modifying a primary dwelling to make it accessible or visitable. Participants need to qualify by income, so that's the 80% or the 200%. They need to be able to make a regular deposit into a savings account, and they need to be willing to attend very thorough financial education classes, as well as asset-specific training. And then once they have done all of that and met their savings goal, then typically their savings are matched 3-to-1. They're a tool, and they're a tool to really help folks gain stability and learn life skills. They teach disciplined savings habits. The courses that are taught, like I said, are asset specific, but so there are things like the ABCs of home buying. If somebody's buying a home, their business plans, in some cases, like learning to do a feasibility study. We had a gentleman that was opening up a print store, and once he started doing his feasibility study, he realized that there was practically a print shop on every corner, and what was really missing in his community was a print shop that did fine art reproduction. He's now geared his business towards that and has been quite successful. In January of last year, we brought on Portland State University to do an outside evaluation of the program through their Regional Research Institute. And so we're tracking data on individuals both when they come into the program, when they graduate from the program, and then we're doing a one-year follow-up. And the preliminary data that we're getting is quite exciting. We're starting to see that individuals are continuing those savings habits. They're using budgets on an ongoing basis. They're starting to do long-term planning, like putting money aside for their children's education, and in some cases even starting up IRAs. So We've currently got about 800 participants in the program. About 700 have graduated and purchased their assets. And we have we went into 2009 at the beginning of the year with a waiting list. So it's a program that's being well utilized. There's some testimonials on the back of or on your sheet that I'll let you look at. But I think the one of the quotes that to me really sums up what this program is a gentleman down in Roseburg named Daryl Green who said, "I believe the most important thing that I learned is that I do not need a windfall or an inheritance to change my finances. What I need is discipline, training, and a goal." And that's really what this program is about. So thank you for your support.
Thank you for your comments. Any questions about this bill?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I can just make one statement. I think that financial literacy is one of the biggest things that we do not do well, and it creates all kinds of problems for people. We deal with it in a lot of other committees, of the decisions people are making because they don't know how to manage their money. I just really applaud you for taking that on. It's just a really important part of something I don't think our education system is dealing with adequately. So thank you very much.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to add real quickly, I know that Jeremy talked about the minimal revenue impact. One thing I just want to make the committee aware of is that the tax credits, we have a, I guess you would call it a self-imposed limit in which we do and that we agreed upon with the legislature in which we go out and allocate this program. So regardless of the fact that you can look at it that there's more people that would be able to apply to this program, we will still run up against that limit in which we issue credits. So you can call it a minimal revenue impact, but we're still going to try to maximize our resources each and every year, and this, in my mind, won't really change the revenue as it relates to this particular change.
So basically, that is a self-imposed cap. In other words, and you had mentioned the waiting list that you have, which I assume would probably with the economy and then this expanded eligibility criteria could continue to expand as well.
Okay.
Well, thank you for your comments on this bill. And I guess we'll at this point then move on to the last of this group of bills, which is Jeremy 2259.
Correct. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is probably the important one for somebody. It changes the name of the Community Action Directors of Oregon to Community Action Partnership of Oregon. And it directs Housing and Community Services Department to provide resources pursuant to ORS 409.750 for training and technical assistance to the partnership.
And
it has no fiscal and no revenue impact.
I certainly hope not. Thank you, Rick. Welcome back to tell us about this important bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
They're all important bills.
We are in the home stretch here with, as Jeremy said, House Bill 2259. And I don't know much more that I would already add to what Jeremy said, but House Bill 2259 does bring Oregon into alignment with national practices for naming community action agency networks by changing the Community Action Directors of Oregon to the Community Action Partnership of Oregon. Community action agency are nonprofit organizations charged with eradicating the causes and conditions of poverty in Oregon. They have been providing programs and services for Oregon's most needy families for decades. Community action agencies do their anti-poverty work in collaboration with a variety of partners representing local, state, and federal governments, as well as community and advocacy groups, policymakers, and low-income leaders. Community Action Directors of Oregon has been governing the board of the community action agencies in Oregon. Community Action Agency Partnership is the national association of all community action agencies across the country. Several years ago, in an effort to create a better understanding and recognition for community action agencies throughout the country, a national movement began to encourage all state trade associations to rename their community organizations to community action partnerships of their respective states. This name alignment creates the branding for the community action agency movement to build greater recognition at a grassroots level. Thank you for the opportunity to represent the department, and I'm happy to answer any questions regarding this name change.
Thank you for your testimony, and we do have another witness signed up, Ryan Fisher, so if you'd like to come forward and then we'll open it up for questions.
Hello.
Afternoon. Welcome to our committee.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Fisher, and I represent the Community Action Partnership of Oregon. I will just add along to what Mr. Krager just said that the reason that this is coming before you is because our name is actually listed in statute. We have a partnership with the state on several items, and so that's why it is a statutory matter that this name change be recognized. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Any questions about this bill from committee members? Senator Minas Anderson.
You say no fiscal impact. You have letterhead and envelopes, and I'm not sure what else would
Secretary
that would have. Yeah, Secretary of State changing it with it.
Well, as a matter of fact, the Community Action Partnership of Oregon has already officially gone through the name change, so this is just recognizing it.
What if we say no? What if we vote no on this?
Large fiscal.
It is an interesting point because I did notice that there's slightly less ink used in the letter P than in the letter D.
So we're actually saving money by passing this bill. Great. Okay, any other questions? Maybe we better leave it at that. Okay, thank you very much both for your testimony. And so I will then close the public hearing on House Bill 2256, 2257, 2258A, and 2259. And I'll open a work session on House Bill 2256.
Madam Chair, do we need to do these separately?
I think it's probably easier for our staff if we do, so let's take them one at a time.
Let's make it easy on our staff. I would move that House Bill 2256 be moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Telfer has moved House Bill 2256 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Do we need a roll call on this? I don't think so. And seeing no objection, the motion carries. We do need a carrier on this bill, so is there a volunteer who would like to carry this bill? Senator Przanski.
There's plenty to go around.
Has volunteered, yes, I think. We all probably have a bill. There's three more to go. So a bill for everyone here.
Yeah, I don't want the last one. Just whatever you do.
That one's going to get real.
I may vote no, just so I don't carry that.
There's a solution. There's a good solution to that problem, Senator George.
I volunteered already. Follow the lead.
Senator Przanski has discovered it. Okay, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2257. And Senator Telfer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2257 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Telfer moves House Bill 2257 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries. Senator George. Thank you so
no
much
problem.
For volunteering.
Really
to carry
happy
this
to do
bill.
That.
No. I know it.
I'm going to vote no just because.
Traitor.
I'll close the work session on House Bill 2257. Open a work session on House Bill 2258. Senator Telfer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2258 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
I think it was already amended, but you're right, it is an A in gross. So Senator Telfer has moved House Bill 2258A to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I believe this was the one where we had a revenue impact statement, but it was minimal, or really there's no change. So is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And Senator Minas Anderson, would you like to carry this bill?
Would love to.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2258A and open a work session on House Bill 2259. Senator Telfer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2259 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Telfer moves House Bill 2259 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It has no revenue and no fiscal impact. So, is there any discussion on that motion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And how about if I volunteer to carry? Okay.
That's why she gets the gavel.
Can we ask you a series of questions on the floor?
Just one.
You could do that.
But just thank you, we'll be back the next day.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so that then with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2259. And members, that completes our agenda. I want to thank everyone who showed up earlier to testify and for all the hard work that went into the report. And with that, we are adjourned.